This is Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal for March 9th, 2017. This is Meredith DeFrancesco. Today we bring you audio from the Augusta State House on March 2nd, where a report on the Maine Indian Land Claim Settlement Act, authored by Suffolk University's Indigenous Peoples' Rights Clinic and commissioned by the Maine Indian Tribal State Commission, was presented to the Joint Legislature's Judiciary Committee. Today we bring you the rough cut from some of that testimony and interviews conducted with the Wabanaki chiefs, all of whom were present. We will bring further analysis and reaction on later programs. Stay tuned for that. We understand today we are not on the air but streaming online. This program will also be in the archives at weru.org. Thank you for listening. We begin today with part of the testimony by co-author Nicole Friedrichs of Suffolk University. The report titled The Draft and Enactment of the Maine Indian Claim Settlement Act, Report on Research and Findings and Initial Observations. Report on Research Findings and Initial Observations included the compilation of documents and communications from the time of the Settlement Act negotiations, with a particular examination of such issues as reserved rights to resources, unabrogated treaty rights, conflicts of terminology between sustenance and subsistence, internal tribal matters, and the application of federal Indian law in Maine. Here is some of the testimony by author Nicole Friedrichs before the judiciary, followed by interviews with tribal leaders.
Finally, Section 1735B and Section 1725H of MCSA create a framework for determining when federal law applies to the tribes and when it will not. Section 1725H provides any federal law which accords special status to the tribes and affects or preempts Maine state law does not apply to the tribes. Using very similar preemption language, Section 1735B prevents the application of federal laws adopted after MCSA to the tribes. The most significant finding on 1725H is that the initial impetus for its inclusion in MCSA was to prevent the application of certain federal environmental laws to the tribes. Instead of using a broad approach ultimately adopted by Congress, the Department of Interior actually suggested enumerating which laws would be excluded from applying. That relatively short list included primarily federal environmental laws and Indian trader statutes. As for Section 1735B, no documents were found explaining why it was included, but it was just added to the bill just a few days before the full House and Senate voted. As a result, there was no discussion by Congress on that particular section. It is worth noting that this broad limitation of federal law to the tribes and the Holton ban is uncommon. Federal authorities, specifically congressional authorities, plenary in governing the relationships between the three sovereigns, the United States, the states, and the tribes. The absence of materials explaining how, why, and by whom Section 35B was included, and the unanswered question of why the DOI's suggestion of enumerating applicable federal laws was rejected calls for a revisitation of those sections. Beyond the specific sections and issues identified by MCSIC to be researched, reviewing over 2,000 pages of documents related to the land claim negotiations and the drafting of the Settlement Act revealed an unexpected finding, namely how rarely the principle of inherent tribal sovereignty was discussed and invoked by Congress and the state, despite being a cornerstone of federal Indian law. A presumable motivation behind this research is the relationship between the state of Maine and the tribes is strained. Conflicts between the two sovereigns are common, as highlighted by the several lengthy and costly court cases, which have centered on the interpretation of MCSA and the MIA. This research sought to uncover additional materials to presumably assist in the interpretations of those settlement acts, and the research does offer a few insights. However, a broader view of the materials raises a different and possibly larger question beyond the legal interpretation of the settlement acts. Namely, is this quote-unquote unique jurisdictional framework adopted by the MIA and MCSA in 1980 working today? That quote-unquote unique jurisdictional model is the tribe status as municipalities and the implicated principle of home rule. Former Maine Attorney General Richard Cohen explained that the jurisdictional model in the MIA was a means to, quote, avoid the types of divisive controversy that has so marked tribal and state relations in the western states and has resulted in so much litigation and ill will. He made that statement in 1980 during the course of drafting MCSA. The status of municipalities and the principle of home rule were characterized as a significant grant of power to the tribes, one of self-government. Congress noted, quote, "In the view of the home rule powers of municipalities in Maine, this also constitutes a significant grant of power to the tribes." The Senate report on MCSA lists as an example of the tribe sovereignty the municipality status. Neither this status nor the other aspects of the jurisdictional arrangement appear to be a great concern to the parties. DOI did not express concern over the jurisdictional arrangement, but instead focused on the municipality status implication for federal versus state funding, which was eventually resolved. The heavy reliance by Congress and the state on the language of municipalities when describing the rights of the tribes and the limited use of the language of tribal sovereignty is one of the most striking findings of the research. In an August 1980 memo to Senator William Cohen, his aide Tim Woodcock offers an insight into this choice of language. He says, quote, "The municipality concept was adopted because it was believed to be the best device to ensure that the tribes remained under Maine law and did not take on the substantial attributes of sovereignty which characterized many of the tribes in the West. The state believed it was avoiding the creation of a nation within a nation, which Governor Longley so vigorously decried." What is remarkable about this statement is the comment that the municipality status was adopted as a means to avoid the substantial attributes of sovereignty. But tribal sovereignty is a foundational principle of federal Indian law, and Congress's use, albeit minimal, is purposeful and significant. The tribes do retain inherent sovereign rights and powers. The municipality concept could not and did not prevent that. This observation is not meant as a legal analysis as to whether inherent tribal sovereignty and the jurisdictional arrangement outlined in the MIA are compatible. Instead, the goal here is to highlight how the Congress and the state thought and talked about the rights of tribes. Theirs was, more often than not, a language of municipalities as arms of the state government and the application of state law, not the foundational federal Indian law principle of inherent tribal sovereignty and plenary federal authority in Indian affairs. But the tension between, one, the effort to limit the substantial attributes of tribal sovereignty and that principle's clear application to the tribes here in Maine, and two, the tension between the effort to limit the application of federal laws to the tribes and the prominence of federal laws for Indians and tribes in their lives generally, begs the question of whether these tensions are resolvable in this framework. The principle of tribal sovereignty has not changed significantly in almost 40 years since the Settlement Acts. In fact, the continued federal policy of self-determination, the adoption of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, affirming the right to self-determination, the Native Nation Building Movement have only strengthened it. It is these concepts, norms, and principles which should be discussed with the goal of reaching a shared understanding of them. And it is these concepts, norms, and principles which should underlie any future negotiations between the state and the tribes in Maine to find a mutually beneficial solution to the conflicts arising from the interpretation of the Settlement Acts. To end, the research and authors of this report encourage all interested individuals and parties to review the materials themselves to develop their own observations and not to rely just on the report. As Jamie pointed out, they're all available online. Ours is just one perspective, one we hope will be useful moving forward. However, the greater promise of the materials that we found lies in others taking the opportunity to review the materials themselves in an effort to glean additional insights and open up a new and constructive dialogue. Thank you for your time.
Kirk Francis, Tribal Chief, Penobscot Nation.
If you could talk with us about the presentation of this report to the judiciary today, the significance of that, and the primary message that you and other Wabanaki chiefs are hoping that the state will get through the presentation of this report.
So I think it's a significant report in the sense that if you go back over two decades now, task forces have been formed, tribal state work groups have been formed, We've got United Nations reports. We got Department of Interior reports. We got all these reports out that basically come to one conclusion that you can see. There is a structural flaw within the Settlement Act that is causing the state and the tribes to be in a perpetual contentious posture. So I think my hope is from this report is that they start to see the whole body of work over the last 20 years, the same conclusions by multiple different people, and that we start to figure out structurally how to turn this government into a place where they can be a partner and work on a government-to-government level with us. I think Congress plays a role in that. I think there's a whole host of things. But for the purposes here today, I think it's critically important that state leaders, especially those in charge of jurisdiction of this issue, the Judiciary Committee, take this report seriously, take the time to understand the condition within Maine tribal communities, and correlate those conditions to the suppression that the tribes have really lived under this act for almost 40 years.
And can you talk a little bit more, we've spoken with you a number of times over some of those issues, and some of them are currently playing out right now, where these varying different interpretations of the act, most specifically by the state, have impacted the tribes negatively?
Yeah, so right now, we're really fighting for our cultural existence in terms of the sustenance fishing rights and our ability to manage that within the main stem of the Penobscot River. We're currently in the First Circuit Court of Appeals on that, where this may be one of the most important cases of the tribe's life. And so, and that all stemmed from an attorney general opinion that we no longer had a sustenance fishing right. And despite, multiple attorney generals before that saying the opposite. So it's this type of authoritative kind of we can do what we want behavior. We can legislate your Aboriginal fishing rights. We can legislate federal Indian law. We can do all of those things here. Fortunately, the United States coming into the case and a lot of people paying attention, the coalitions we're forming in this state, people are starting to hold the state accountable for that behavior. Another one is water quality standards. It does you no good to have a sustenance fishing right if the water's too toxic to eat the fish. So the federal EPA, US EPA, implemented federal water quality standards and denied Maine's water quality application. Well, just this week, and I don't think anybody's aware of this, Governor LePage has petitioned Scott Pruitt to overturn that decision. Yes. And so these are the kind of things that should be ending up in consultation, in good dialogue, in figuring out what is exactly the solution. There is, the report has already come out, there is no economic impact, for example, of enhanced water quality in the Penobscot River. It's about control again. And we got to really get over that. Or this, and if they don't really take a serious approach in trying to... we're not saying make the Settlement Act go away, but get it in line with what federal Indian law and how Indians have relationships with states and the United States all over this country. And so Maine lags far behind, therefore the tribes do. And until they get serious about that, this relationship will probably never get better.
You are listening to Radioactive on WERU Community Radio. Today, we're bringing you audio and interviews from the Augusta State House on March 2nd, where a report on the Maine Indian Land Claim Settlement Act, authored by the Suffolk University's Indigenous Peoples' Rights Clinic, was presented to the Joint Legislature's Judiciary Committee. Again, Penobscot Nation Chief Kirk Francis.
And if you could quickly speak to then, the Maine Indian Tribal State Commission has been in existence since the formation of the Land Claim Settlement Act, specifically set up to review gray areas, advise, made up of both state and tribal commissioners. And what are you hoping going forward that there will be, this commission will now be given the teeth that it was originally intended to have? Do you predict that perhaps the federal government has to step in on behalf of the tribes more in this relationship? You have the structure here, but not necessarily, as you pointed out, results.
So it's a great point. I mean, I think that MITSIC, which was formed in statute, if you look at the conversation and you listen to the report by Suffolk here today, they will say that the bulk of the conversation revolved around the state and the tribes resolving the issues in Maine. Now, you have to believe that when you create an entity like MITSIC, that is the third-party dispute resolution. As you point out, equally appointed by the governor, equally appointed by the tribes, this would seem to be the fairest forum to deal with issues around the Settlement Act, as they're statutorily charged to do. So the problem is their authority has been minimized. They've been given no authority under the law, and they get, by and large, ignored. So I think MITSIC is a great opportunity to provide a fair third-party dispute mechanism. If you look at state government, tribal government, any government, it's multi-headed, right? You have branches of government. So where does that relationship start and end, kind of, when you have no Office of Indian Affairs, you have no staff people dealing with Indian Affairs within the governor's office, you have no committee that's really has the expertise or the day-to-day kind of knowledge of Indian communities. So without getting more structurally set up in state government, without empowering things like the Maine Indian Tribal State Commission, again, you know, there's always going to be, at the very least, a perception of unfairness, and again, it'll lead to kind of these contentious attitudes.
Brenda Commander from the Houlton Banamalsi Indians, Tribal Chief.
Well, thanks for talking with us today. So we'd love to get your reflections on the presentation of this report today to the Judiciary Committee specifically, and having perhaps, will you tell me, a fresh look at the Maine Indian Land Claims Settlement Act and its effects, the effects of differing interpretations on the part of the state versus the tribe, and a number of issues currently and historically since the Act was passed.
Over the past years, the Houlton Banamalsi Indians, and I'm sure the other tribes, have appeared before the Judiciary Committee and other committees to introduce certain bills over, things that were jurisdiction and other issues, which were never passed. Very few bills have passed, and I think it really was a lack of understanding and ambiguity over some of the legal language of the Act. And this presentation is the unbiased work and review of the Suffolk Law School, and on the federal side of the 1980 Land Claim Settlement Act. And so it is important because it provides timelines and documents and things like that. And it really will be an important tool for us as we move forward into the future to continue work on that and in more detail. But that is to be determined. We are going to have a tribal leaders meeting in 2 months, all of us together, and we're going to do some strategic planning on the next steps and where do we go from here. And because it's just, there's really no mechanism here at the state. We have tried many, many times, and it's just a total lack of education and understanding of the sovereignty and the rights of Indian nations, and they're not under the control of the state, and we do what we do ourselves. I mean, we're really, over the past 35 years, like, we are so pleased about all of the accomplishments that we've made, and we've done that ourselves, but we have to live beside our neighbors, but we want to make sure that, you know, they understand too that we have authority over our tribal lands and environment and the things that we do.
Can you mention any issues currently that your tribe are facing, or that the Wabanakis are facing as a whole, that you are concerned that the state is discounting, perhaps in its through its misinterpretation of the Maine Indian Land Claims Settlement Act. And I don't know whether mining might be part of that. I know your tribe has been facing the possibility of mining being opened up in the state.
Yes, we have been involved with the mining, weakened mining rules since 2012, excuse me. And we have been there because it's in our county, it's in our backyard. We have a water bottling plant 8 miles from the mountain, and we were not consulted with. The state is really pushing this, and it's, you know, the effects of it will be so devastating for our lands that we have worked on for the past 36 years to keep our environment clean. And it affects so much. It's going to affect the future generations. And so that's one issue. But the other is the water quality standards and other things like that. When it comes to the environment, you know, I don't have a degree in environmental science or anything, but just what my ancestors have taught me. And that's what we actually live, and we do that on our lands. And so we, even though the state, there's a case right now going on with the state of Maine suing EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, over waters with our tribe and the other tribes.
The water quality standards.
Yes, and we feel that's an important That's very important that we continue to be involved with that.
Well, I see it's time to go in now to the hearing, and thank you very much for joining
us. Thank you very much.
My name is Charlie Peter Paul. I'm chief of the Rustic Band of Mi'kmaqs.
As we spoke earlier, the Mi'kmaq were not a party to the Maine Indian Land Claims Settlement Act, but still are a part of the implications going forward. Would like your particular reflections on this examination of the Settlement Act and how it impacts Wabanaki tribes, but specifically your tribe currently.
Well, it impacts all the tribes economically. I mean, it economically oppresses us. We don't have the same opportunities as the other tribes in the United States. I mean, there's 566 recognized tribes in the United States. And out of that, there's 11 that have restricted settlement acts. I think that, you know, if given the chance, the tribes in the state of Maine could change the economic future of the state of Maine. But with these regulations and the rules that we have to follow underneath the state of Maine, there's no reason for businesses to come to our territories.
Can you talk about some specific issues where you feel up against restrictions that with the state's interpretation of the tribe's sovereignty?
One huge one is OVAWA.
The Violence Against Women Act.
Yes. I mean, that's huge. I mean, I don't see any harm it does to the state of Maine to be able to prosecute offenders on our property, you know, to our women. All we want is to be able to take care of our own people. That's really what it comes down to. The most offensive thing to the Mi'kmaqs is that we did not have a seat at the table and we're being held to an agreement. Who else in the state of Maine could do that? I mean, if your parents made an agreement for you that went against all your values, how could you stand behind that? To me, it was a horrible thing.
So just to clarify for people who don't know, the Mi'kmaq were not a party of the act, but are they being considered right now that the Maine Indian Land Claims Settlement Act rules, as it were, apply to your tribe?
Yes, the rules apply. The Aristic Band of Mi'kmaqs does not have a jurisdictional agreement with the state of Maine. That's one huge issue that we face today. It was supposed to be negotiated. It wasn't negotiated. It was a one-sided negotiation. That's not negotiating.
And finally, any reflections, hopes, concerns, or cynicism about the compilation of this report and the presentation and the intention being put out by this report that the state and the tribes negotiate further on a better understanding going forward?
I think there needs to be more negotiations. I mean, we're a sovereign nation living inside the boundaries of the state of Maine. I don't think Maine can just come in and say, you have to follow these rules. To me, it's not fair. We've been here for hundreds of thousands of years. This is our land. We've been here.
Yeah, my name is Ralph Dana. I'm the tribal chief for the Passamaquoddy tribe at Pleasant Point.
So could you give us some of your reflections on the presentation of this report today to the Judiciary Committee of the Legislature and the hopes of your tribe in conjunction with the other Wabanaki tribes of the hopes of reflecting or the examination of this report, what it might be able to do to benefit tribal-state relations?
It appeared it was a lot of very good, diligent work had gone into this report, and I think it's that kind of work would be a foundation for future endeavors to take that information and turn that into some clear objectives. Where do we want to go? What do we want this to be? One of the drawbacks that I saw today based on sitting in on this hearing was it's very apparent that if you have two entities that are at odds for whatever reason, and if one of those entities has been able to manipulate, interpret, or take whatever the issue may be and use that for their advantage, it is absolutely incredibly difficult to expect them to say this needs to be revisited. I mean, that is just, it sounds like the might is right. Why would you do that? Why would you say, so I'm hopeful, as a tribal chief, that the people on this committee, the people who have a say in this, who can affect this, essentially will do the right thing. I keep hopeful of those things, and I think that speaks to the larger picture of even humanity. Just do the right thing here, and it's beyond a document that was entered into in 1980. So I think I was somewhat disappointed today that it was difficult for the committee to really understand, I think, things on that level. You heard questions about money and policy and procedure and Robert's rules of order with regard to meetings and things of that nature, and that's so far removed from what we're talking about here.
And can you talk a little bit about your concerns, which have been concerns of the tribes since the passage of this act and till present time, your concerns about how the state has been applying the Maine Indian Land Claims Settlement Act, how they've been applying it, how that has been affecting the tribes, being exempt from certain federal laws, how it's been affecting cases such as water rights, fishing rights?
I think my background is primarily in law enforcement. I've been in that capacity for the Passamaquoddy tribe for well over 20 years. And I say that because as a conservation officer, one of the things in the Land Claim Settlement Act, it does allow the tribes to have exclusive authority for hunting, fishing, and trapping. That's one of the highlights, I think, in the Land Claim Settlement Act. Beyond that, it starts getting pretty skinny, I think, for highlights in the Land Claim Settlement Act and what it's done for the tribes, or in a lot of cases, hasn't done. It's unfortunate that, this many years later, as was discussed in the presentation and earlier today, things haven't changed. They haven't. I mean, we've identified these. There's been a tremendous amount of work that's gone into this to identify the deficiencies, the misinterpretations, the damage that it's done to tribes. And we're still here today talking about the same thing. Hopefully this will get some things going. I try to remain optimistic, but it's guarded optimism, I think, would be a way to characterize my impression of the Land Claim Settlement Act and how successful we would be addressing these issues with the state.
And you have been listening to Radioactive on WERU Community Radio.